Hey, 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 it's Mark here, and you are listening to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe Comics Podcast. Now, this episode is a live recording from Assembly Required. So the Talking Joe podcast had the privilege of moderating Josh Blaylock's panel at Assembly Required, the fantastic G.I. Joe convention that takes place in Des Moines, Iowa. See the website, codenameiowa.com. Now, this happened on Saturday, the 4th of November, 2023. Tim Finn and I were there in person moderating Josh Blaylock's panel. So we have a recording of this. The first few minutes of it were from my mobile phone, and the remaining from Hooded Cobra Commander Brian's recording, which was also supported by David T. Allen. So big thanks to them for being able to document this. So because it was live in a conference room without necessarily the best of audio technology to record it all, it doesn't have quite the audio fidelity that you may be used to from Talking Joe, but I've listened back to it. It's definitely listenable, and you can make out what's being said. A lot of the ground that is covered here is stuff that we have talked to Josh Blaylock before in our more in-depth interview, which was from July 2021. So you can look back on our archives and find that on YouTube or as a audio-only podcast on the normal podcast platforms. So without further ado, let's head on over to that echoey conference room for a couple of minutes of really ropey audio, followed by slightly better but still relatively ropey audio. enjoy.
Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
Talking Joe is on the air.
Welcome the man who does all the work for Talking Joe. I just show up and talk. Mark.
And I just
show up. But your applause should be for our guest, Josh Blaylock. Creator, writer, penciler, anchor?
Sometimes.
For
con sketches.
publisher and owner of what's Devil's Do Publishing?
Devil's Do Studios.
Devil's Do Studios. And you know him from G.I. Joe, Josh Blaylock.
Broad sweep, time of links to G.I. Joe, writer of G.I. Joe, issue 1 in 2001 through to issue 25. Then also 2003 G.I. Joe versus Transformers Mini, Dreadnoughts Declassified, Arashikage Showdown, mini graphic novel, manga style, and then beyond that, overseeing G.I. Joe at Devil's Due until it's continuing on in comics, because you're still doing it, things like Mercy Sparks, Arc World, and in Codex.
Yep.
Okay, so it's September of 2001, and G.I. Joe issue number 1 is published. But let's go back 6 months, a year or two, and what are the events surrounding you getting to make G.I. Joe comics?
We got 45 minutes. So try not to make this a length of the podcast.
So the short version.
I have always been wanting to do comics. I started self-publishing comics as soon as high school was done. I just started getting it out there and distributed. And so I fell into a day job right out of art school. I just went to a 2-year kind of portfolio school that taught you how to do, they were doing licenses, and we got, I got to be part of this whole 80s retro line that they did. And which I kind of spearhead and prove that for the first time that people wanted this 80s retro stuff, it was it blew up in the malls and everything. So that gave me what I needed to know to pitch to Hasbro. So I set up the comics I was publishing and, put together an official licensing proposal. And to my shock, they responded back. And yeah, that was probably, I don't remember if that was like late 2000. I think it was. And then over the course of like a few months, contract happened, secured the rights, agreed to a ridiculous royalty. And because I wasn't going to, you know, mess around with any of the chances to secure it. And then once I locked it in, I went to Image Comics instead of self-publishing it, and I did a deal with them.
Can you tell us about your pitch to Hasbro itself? Because, of course, G.I. Joe is very important, so I'm sure you must have dressed up in the suit and tie, gone down to their corporate offices with some PowerPoint and slides. You know, obviously, that's the kind of thing that happens in this lockdown corporate environment, right?
You know what's funny is back when that place I worked for was trying to get the license, I made this crazy elaborate like pitch. I got a with the Army Navy surplus store. I got a big metal, you know, ammo, you know, container, and put all the file cards in it. You know, like a file folders and all kinds of things in it. And like barely any response.
And then when I went on my own to pitch the comic book, it was like an email, a phone call up Hasbro. Who's at the licensing department to talk to? What's their contact? And said I was interested in making this pitch. Sent an email with the proposal and then mailed in some stuff with like samples of art of like what a few pages would look like and the terms and samples of the other stuff I published, which were like these black and white comics. And then they responded, so they were interested. And then they sent back, you know, what the deal terms would be and just some back and forth emails. And, you know, I didn't bring up that I didn't have like a big office. There was no need to bring that up. But also, I mean, I sent them the books I was publishing. I wasn't pretending to be something I wasn't.
You were a one-person, black-and-white comics, self-publishing, convention-driving-to comics publisher, indie comics guy.
Yeah, I mean, I was nationally distributed, but yeah, I was still just driving, you know, to the cons, every con I could get to the weekends, working my day job, publishing comics on the side.
And you had... And how many employees did you have when you pitched?
Zero.
The Devil's
we had a team. We had the team in place. I mean, they saw, I think what got them was the art, like four or five sample of like what the first few pages of the story would be, which I think we redrew them, but they're pretty similar. And it was Steve Kurth. There was an artist, Steve Kurth, I went to. The story's been told a few times before, but I went to my friend Tim Seeley, who was another artist, like, trying to break in, and he said, I'm not good enough to do G.I. Joe. But talked to my friend Steve, who's a little bit older, and then he said, cool. I said, hey, I don't have any money, but I'm going to go for this. If it works out, you know, we'll all be involved. And so that, and I got, I think I-Fi Color Design agreed to color the samples. I honestly can't remember. I have no idea. I might have colored this myself. But we set those in, and yeah, that was what landed it. So, but now what I didn't know was, I'm pretty sure from what I've heard in hindsight, like, you got to think again, like, nobody had ever done an 80s retro thing yet in comics. And the people in charge all did not understand that, like, everyone who was like early 20s and younger was like dying for that stuff to come back, and they just didn't get it. And which shocked me, because in the stores I had just seen like everyone freaking out over like G.I. Joe and Transformers and Ninja Turtle and Voltron and Thundercats t-shirts and stuff back in like Hot Topic and things like that. So
which you had been designing some of.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
that small company.
Yeah. And so I got to see, like, and this isn't just something I think. This is validated now. But they were just, they didn't get it. It wasn't just Hasbro. A lot of people didn't get it back then. But they really didn't get it. And I'm pretty sure they right before I contacted them, that they had taken it to, like, Marvel to, like, you know, and maybe been a little too, combination of being a little too cocky. Like, you're so lucky that, like, we're offering this back to you. At the same time, Marvel not getting it and being like, why would we want to do this 80s thing? Like, and or by, you know, so I think I might have slid in just the right time.
So we think of this 80s nostalgia boom. You know, Thundercats came back with some comics in the 2000s. Transformers was really big at Dreamwave. G.I. Joe, Battle of the Planets, some other things. So
Masters of the Universe,
thank you. It's important to remember that G.I. Joe was the first of these to come back. And also at the time, Hasbro has just come off of a couple years of unsuccessful G.I. Joe, no G.I. Joe, or very small limited G.I. Joe releases at Toys R Us. And Hasbro in 2000 is really focused on Star Wars, because they're between episodes 1 and 2.
I forgot about that.
And yeah. They had just bought or licensed some video games, or like a little video game library or a little video game company. And Hasbro was not focused on something like G.I. Joe. So in terms of sneaking in.
And here today, you know, today we're thinking of Hasbro, we're thinking of like the IP and, you know, the millions, billions that are behind these things, and how carefully they sort of like choose to market them in films and toys, and the success that Classified is now today. Sort of G.I. Joe, Hasbro is a very different place to that, and sort of the reaction that kind of you got was very interesting in terms of like asking for things like, story bibles or character bibles.
Yeah.
Or some of the reactions.
Yeah, the funniest thing I always talk about is how, like, at first, you know. So I think once they gave me the license and realized it was getting traction, it kind of freaked them out, because then they realized, oh, we just gave this unknown kid, like, the keys to the Lamborghini. And
the 80s.
But I had this really bizarre amount of experience already with licensing, because I, you know, just been in, just fell into that earlier. And I had been self-publishing for years, and so I'm like, do you have, you know, style guides? Like, I went looking for like big character bibles. I was ready to for them to receive like all of, give me all of the rules. Like, here's what you can and can't do in this universe. Here's like the current versions we want you to use. And I'm ready to think like, man, I hope I don't have to like, you know, argue with them over which version of this character to use. And some, like the first person I talked to didn't know who Snake Eyes was. So, yeah, and so, like, there was no style guides. So, I was kind of like, well, cool, I could just, because I wanted to, like, put the team together, pick who I wanted to really focus and bring back, and then redesign them for what fit into the year, you know, the year 2001, which was basically, like, you know, everybody just kind of wanted to see the original designs tweaked a little bit and just, like, made a little more badass, like, whatever that meant at the time. Or things like, I did make this change, like Shipwreck, I just got him out of the old, like, Navy gear, made him more like, you know, the blue knit cap and sweater, and Snake Eyes pretty much stuck with that second version. Just put the Arashikage symbol on his shoulder for the first time, and tweaked his, like, armband and stuff a little bit, and
you didn't just write the opening issues. You also provided some art for them. What was that? What's your writing process?
So I had always written and drawn all my own stuff, or I would always work in some collaboration with other people. So I, you know, part of it was necessity, and part of it was like I wanted to put my stamp and my vision on it. And then design the characters, write the story, but I would do the layouts too. So those first few issues, I don't remember how many issues it was, but I did the layouts before I handed them over to Steve Kurth, and then, you know, from there, you know, he would do everything, and he designed a couple of the characters too over time. And then I think as time went on, it just, now we were running, and it was more like just his show for after that.
Then the success of the first issue was a great surprise, or was it? How did that hit?
Yeah. So that was like, that was, so every single relationship was kind of a weird dynamic. The Hasbro thing was weird. First, they didn't understand why anyone would care. And then when they realized everyone cared a lot, then they freaked out that we had the license. But then we were selling really well, you know? But then they were also like, they didn't understand the comics market. So they thought like 100,000 copies sold out with a reprint of another 30,000 copies, sold out with a reprint of another collection. They thought that was like kind of bad, which was at the time was fantastic for comic sales. So there was that, and then like Image Comics, I signed a deal with them, and I think they weren't really used to doing licensed properties like that. And I, you know, I mean, I just grew up idolizing those guys and everything, so I was thrilled to be there. But I think it even kind of threw off the management there at the time, like, oh man, because they didn't get it either. There was like one guy at Image that really, I think, understood this is going to be big, but the main management there was like, what is happening? And they ended up putting it on the preview to the cover to the Diamond retailer catalog, and we had pre-orders of like 70,000 copies, and I pushed Image to go ahead and print 100,000, so we would make sure we had enough in stock.
Which they might have thought was risky.
Yeah, they did not want to do that. And then I had to argue like, well, that's my, you know, they just take their flat fee. That's the way that company works. So I was like, well, it'd be my loss anyway if I'm wrong. When you're printing 70,000, it doesn't cost much of anything more to print another 30,000. So they're like, okay, fine. And then, so then we were ready to go. And then that was September 11th, 2001, and the book was coming out September 12th. So we did have crazy hype. We had people like in a fervor on the message boards. Wizard Magazine, which was like the Rolling Stone magazine of the era, was covering it. I mean, it was ready. It was pumped, set up to be this big hit. But just the craziest timing. And 9/11 happens. And so it's weird. Like, you know, it's kind of silly to say that that didn't have an effect on some of the sales, but it was like people were already like amped up. I think it was just changed the vibe the next day when people came in there and there's this big J. Scott Campbell American flag cover. That's how it all, the whole thing launched.
All right, so you're writing a book, and but you also own this company. So I'm shifting gears a little bit here, not just in that first 6 months or year, but over the years with the Joe license. Can you talk about owning and running a business? You had employees and freelancers.
Yeah. My first comic book imprint was called Labyrinth Studios in 1996, 97, 98, 99, 2000. Then no one could pronounce or spell Labyrinth. So I was like, I got to change to something else. I was working with this like, you know, apparel company. And I was like, I'm going to make like something that just sounds cool. Doesn't mean anything. It could be a streetwear line. It could be my art studio, comic studio, a band, even though I don't play music, but it could be anything. And so I came up with Devil's Due. And then I started Devil's Due Studios doing freelance and was planning like, I've got enough freelance now to quit my job. I'm just going to build this up, keep publishing my comics, and 5 years from now, I'll probably have enough stuff built up. And then decided to make the shot for the license, and that worked. So all of a sudden, you know, that new brand name just suddenly had... I published one book in this place, which was like a black and white book that came out just as Devil's Due. And then Image, I mean, the deal was already done, ready to go for G.I. Joe. So... like Devil's Due was sort of, from the outside perspective, appears to have been born alongside G.I. Joe. And I don't know what it's like. I never knew anything other though than like comics is a business. Like comic books is a commercial art. And I just through lack of patience, probably as a teenager, since I was like 14, was writing letters to publishers and trying to figure out how to, you know, I was trying to get hired long before I was qualified. And then, you know, right around the time I was starting to get good enough to maybe get hired, I ended up just self-publishing. And then, you know, just kind of never escaped self-publishing.
Right, so
and maybe then started having to add employees when G.I. Joe took off.
Okay.
Actual employees in an office.
So though it's a big jump to go from just you to renting an office and having employees, it sounds like there's a trajectory that was already there. You were already a business person.
Already like having to deal with like invoices and purchase orders and understanding that part of it and dealing with the printers. But yeah, not like managing people and having staff and all that. So that was like typical entrepreneurial thing of, you know, okay, work your ass off and do everything until you can start hiring people. And started with a little office, like an 8x8 closet, and then took over another, like an actual bigger room, and then took over another room in this little building above a 7-Eleven in Chicago. And then I think within a year after that, though, we had half a dozen employees. I think at our peak, we were 12 employees with like 50 or 60 contractors at any given time.
And conventions.
Yeah.
And so you travel and hustle.
Yeah, a lot of conventions, a lot of... So, yeah, at the peak craziness is when I had to, like, dial it back, just otherwise, you know, you realize you're human and you can't do this. I was in mid-20s. I've already been running the company for a couple of years. I'm, like, you know, writing 4 or 5 books a month, still designing and doing sketches and drawings and stuff, and managing, like, all these employees who all have their own dynamic, and then dealing with, yeah, just dealing with everything. So,
and it's sort of getting into the detail of the comics a little bit, and given where we are with Assembly Required, with our Dreadnought theme, the book itself sort of started off with a bang, with Dreadnoughts being quite a big focus there. You introduce the character of Zartan's daughter into the mythos, and you also have Dreadnoughts Declassified miniseries. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, the Dreadnoughts in your Devil's Due universe and kind of your thoughts and feelings about that?
Yeah, Dreadnoughts were always just fun. I always tell a little bit of story. Like, my uncle is like a total biker, and I'd seen in some like biker motorcycle club, like, you know, culture growing, like, as a, you know, in high school and stuff, I started to like notice all that, and I thought it'd be fun. I thought since we're making the story a little more, like, it could be a little older, you know, it wasn't just being written for kids. Like, I could throw some more of this actual, like, biker vibe in here, but it's still got to be Dreadnoughts. It's still got to be their over-the-top Mad Max type characters, you know. And just enjoyed. I mean, all the villains are always fun to write in anything. So, but it was kind of like a little precursor. Like, Sons of Anarchy wasn't out yet, you know, so it was like, know what Dreadnoughts would really be like. But it was always fun to think of, like, Cobra as this network. You know, you've got this Cobra Commander guy who's got this, like, subversive domestic terrorism operation, and then he partners with, like, a major arms dealer from overseas, but then he partners with, like, a domestic bike gang. And I was just like, well, we were picking up, you know, in the Marvel continuity several years after the, you know, team had been disbanded and now Cobra Commander's back. I was like, well, what have the Dreadnoughts been doing this whole time? Zartan doesn't just stop, you know, running things. So he's built it up, and now there's national chapters. And that would, like, that's, I guess that was the biggest thing I did with Dreadnoughts, is make them officially a nationwide gang with different, I envisioned they would just have chapters in every major city. So now they really are their own force. And so, one, they could give Cobra a run for their money, or if Cobra Commander partners back up with them, it's a really big concern for G.I. Joe and the powers that be.
And I think you're the only writer who's ever written a Dreadnought series in comics.
That's hard to believe.
with beautiful covers by Clement Suave, who also went on to do very interesting things. You had a good track record of getting on some very interesting talent onto the books. Can you tell us about that book and what it was that brought you back to writing a G.I. Joe book after a bit of time away as the head honcho?
Mark's referring to Dreadnoughts Declassified. So we had started doing these Declassified miniseries, so where we just basically go back and get to, like, really dig into the origin if it had never been totally explained, or slightly update things, you know, like, so that we did the Snake Eyes Declassified and G.I. Joe Declassified. And, Brandon Jerwa did the Snake Eyes one, and then Larry Hama actually did the G.I. Joe Declassified and got to expand on his origin story for them more. So we had Scarlet.
Shooter, who's now a toy again.
Yeah. And then we had, So anyway, we did a great, fun Scarlet one-shot by Phil Noto. And then I got to do... Yeah, Dreadnoughts was one of the obvious ones to do. And I don't remember if I was just like, yeah, I want to do that one, or if one of the editors came back and asked me. But I just thought it was a fun challenge too, because Zartan had the most conflicting backstory of any character. The toy car, the comic said a couple different conflicting things. The cartoon had its whole thing. There was the whole, like, well, in the comics, there was, like, the chameleon DNA references for his disguise abilities, and then there was also the, but then there was still holograms, and then the cartoon, it was, like, masks, but he also, like, for a split second, was affected by the sun, and then they just kind of stopped worrying about that. And then there was...
Gotta sell that toy.
The
color-changing glass.
The file card mentioned all this stuff that was never really brought up later, so I thought, how do I make all that work? And that's—I think—that is my one of my strong suits. For my faults, that's one of my strong suits as a writer, is putting pieces together and making them work. Like being given a set of toys and making them all fit together. I think I pulled it off, but it ended up being like the most difficult approval thing I've ever done with Hasbro. Not just by coincidence of like regime changes and who the all of a sudden, like, here I'm writing the most, you know, morally gray character in the Joe universe, and yet all of a sudden getting resistance. Like, now it's for their first time they've ever said to us, like, well, the good guys need to be good and the bad guys need to be bad. And like, you know, why does Zartan have to have this, like, messed up childhood that maybe to motivate him? Can he just be a bad guy? And I'm like, it's his origin story, and like, this is, you know, so we managed to still get it out. And hopefully, so people still like it, I think.
I love it. That's probably the best one.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that story, though.
Can you talk about writing stories of different lengths and the trade paperback packaging and markets when Devil's Due had G.I. Joe? That you'd collect issues and you were selling the comics, but you were also then selling the collections.
Yeah.
Because the graphic novel business is so big now, and it's starting to get big.
Yeah, it was like, that was like right when all the bookstores all of a sudden, mid-2000s, like a switch flipped, and all of a sudden librarians all wanted comics, and the school libraries were like, hey, and kids seem to be reading comics more, and it's getting kids to read. And then comics became like the graphic novels were the fastest growing component of all of publishing in every bookstore. And this is when we had I think it's also because that's when we had the explosion of like Borders and Barnes and Noble
and
just
manga
being built everywhere. And they were being popping up. And then manga comes in. Tokyo Pop revolutionizes manga in the United States. So they just wanted graphic novels. So it had always been, you know, done where you just, after a certain amount of issues, you collect them into a trade paperback. With the Dreadnoughts Declassified, they were 48 page books because we knew we could get them out and have a higher price point and, you know, within 3 months, get them all out. And then boom, you've got, you know, a nice thick trade paperback collection. So the G.I. Joe trade paperbacks never really sold like crazy, though. They're always just like enough to keep. Like they always were way more of a floppy comic periodical market. Like the fans that wanted it now. I think now, you know, having it bingeable is probably, you know, something people like.
Okay,
now people on the most collections. We were really, I think, we're credited as some of the earliest omnibus like pioneers back then.
Right, like that big Voltron book?
Voltron, G.I. Joe versus Transformers,
yeah.
Forgotten Realms, and then World War III.
Which I think was forced on you because Hasbro said that you weren't allowed to collect them until the very end.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
and it might be, it might feel risky to do a book collecting 12 issues if the market has been used to books collecting 4 or 6
yeah.
at a time.
I don't think we were nervous about that one, though, because that story was so good, and I knew it was like a big epic.
Mm. Yeah.
It was I felt more like, if you don't want this one, you're crazy. Like, that was, Mark Powers did such a great job with that.
Okay, it's 2023. Real American Hero is in its 41st year, and sorry, everyone. For over 5 years, you were in charge of one major component of G.I. Joe. So this is a broad question. Can you reflect on sort of what G.I. Joe is or where G.I. Joe is now compared to where it's been or where you maybe see it going?
That's a really good, hard to answer question. Like, I mean, there's no question, like, back then it was part of the, like, just the fabric of pop culture with, you know, at least with, like, the younger male demographic in the United States. I mean, it was just massive. And then we can take credit for truly giving it the biggest boost it ever had since that first wave that was a little, like, hit and miss every time until those comics came along. And by default, that catalyzing a whole other 80s retro boom in the comic world at the time that the comic book market was becoming so important to wider pop culture and film and entertainment, I think we really pushed, and we brought a lot of people back in the comic shops. They stayed to read other things. But, like, since then, I mean, the comics after us, I mean, they just kind of kept going. You know, I don't think that anything major, amazing happened. Because by then, and I wouldn't, that's no, like, diss on them. That's just, it kind of needed, we'd already did it for 7 years. So anything after a while needs to kind of, like, take a breather and have a big, like, something to have a big move to come back. And that was supposed to be those movies. And that didn't work. So there, now it's like, it's in this, you know, I think it's in a delicate time where, like, is it going to have a resurgence or is it just going to, like, be its own thing, you know, from its own older previous era? So, you know, now we'll see what happens with the stuff that the stuff is, you know, Kirkman's doing and all that. I mean, if anybody has the clout in the entertainment space to bring it back and who has a track record of, you know, being talented and creative enough to do it, I mean, it's definitely that guy. So we'll see. I mean, I have no idea what's going on there. So, I mean, that all looks really fun.
Yeah.
The new stuff on Larry's book, that artwork looks incredible.
So it's an interesting dynamic where we are in 2023 with the new Skybound relaunch just on the horizon versus 2001, where it's in this, you know, it's a nostalgia project that probably trying to get people in for that energy that they experienced in the 80s for the audience in probably their early 20s versus that same audience now being a little bit, you know, over their early 20s.
It has always been such a challenge with that is that you can't just to bring in new people. Like, if you had to only bring in new people, it would be very difficult, you know. You have, but it doesn't work anymore. It's not strong enough to just bring in the previous crowd.
Mm.
That's not enough to support it either. It has to be, you have to do both. You have to really give it the fan service to generate excitement with all us old heads. But there's got to be some new way. And I just kind of think there's been so much of a gap since it was, like, a big, like, fervor. There needs to be sort of a break in, like, okay, this is what it was, and here's the new way. And I don't know. I've got some ideas I don't really want to give out on how I would handle that. But unless someone wants to have me do it. Right now it's, you know, it's just kind of hanging out. It's kind of where I feel like it's kind of like when people were keeping Star Wars alive, you know, in between that long gap between the movies and when it was just like a Dark Horse comic and, you know, there was like a small dedicated, like fan base having conventions and stuff.
And we talked a little bit about some of that relationship with Hasbro being a bit like and maybe a bit more problematic at times, and then not maybe quite understanding the property. They had a great quote about your use of Baroness and Destro. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Just literally somebody thought I was like adding like a pimp and a dominatrix into the story. I say profit director.
But beyond that, I think you had some involvement with Hasbro in a more creative way. That I had this story from talking to Chris Lai, who was the artist on Arashi Kagi Showdown, about him, you know, being an intern at Devil's Due, and one Friday night, you everyone's sort of, you know, working a bit late. You come up to him and said, Hasbro has asked us to do some designs for this thing called Sigma 6. Can you draw me some things? And we, you know, fax them back out to them. Can you remember that?
I don't even remember that conversation. I remember us doing Sigma 6. I remember him doing them. Yeah, we were, I had a side business for a long time where we just started, you know, providing extra service for Hasbro, for all kinds of companies. But, they, you know, that was just like this obvious connection. So we did a bunch of art for, I had somebody else managing this stuff at that point, but like we provided art for a bunch of G.I. Joe trading cards that Wizards of the Coast did. We did a lot of like some toy design, turnaround stuff. Chris Lee did the Sigma 6.
A lot of those,
yeah. They would also poach comic talent. You know, just the toy designers would see the comics and be like, who is that artist? And they would just call the artist directly. And that's how like Clément Sauvé got, you know, did like the Renegades. You know, I'm sure a bunch of other artists that I might have been aware of.
what that side business, what was the name on that side business?
It was just Devil's Due Creative.
Okay.
That's what I called it. And eventually I partnered with somebody else and it was supposed to be expanded, called it Kunoichi. But then it just ended up being like, at the end of the day, and even after I ended up leaving that company, they really were still just doing Hasbro and toy stuff. It never became like the expanded agency it was supposed to be. So I should have just kept it as it was originally.
If any of you have the box set of the whole Sunbow DVD, all the episodes on DVD, it's like the two thick plastic clamshells inside the sleeve on the back. It says package design, Kunoichi. So that's an example of what that later company did. When is our, who's representing the con? When's our end time?
Well, I know there's another panel at 2:00.
So. All right, so we've got time for audience questions. Would anyone like to, David?
I would like to know a little bit more about the relationship between Devil's Due and Hasbro, because there's been a lot of dispersed rumors about that relationship. I've spoken with Gerald DePriest, I've spoken with you. There's different levels that you've described to me. Can you just explain to the audience these different levels of Hasbro that you had to deal with in the handling of certain aspects of the property with you, with your relationship?
So you had the licensing department, that's who we technically were interacting with. So they... Everyone that, like, if you made, you know, My Little Pony, you know, erasers, you're going to go through the licensing department. But, which is kind of funny when you think about that, is like comics are, you're literally creating more fiction and expanding the fantasy of a massive property. So it's, you know, it's I don't even know if they do it that way anymore. They didn't really think about comics as much back then. And, there was licensing, and then within licensing, there'd be like, you know, the person who's just checking the basic stuff, like make sure there's no like curse words in here or too much, you know, someone's face isn't getting blown off like graphically or something. And then there'd be kind of like an art director, the person kind of looking over that too within that department. But then it would also go to like the toy department, like the branding and stuff. And, so then you'd have someone from the actual Joe brand who's in charge of everything Joe, like looking at it. making sure they were cool with it. And then they would go to legal, in that legal department, and they would just look for it to, you know, lawyer it up.
make sure that names are okay. Or
yeah, they're the ones that make sure nothing. and then every now and then, well, if there's any kind of press or anything like that, then it would go to the PR department. And then, you know, when it, like once every 6 months or something, one of the higher ups looks at it and either is like, this is great, or gets mad about something, you know. And that's just any licensing situation at a big company is like that. So, you know, it is usually the general flow is in the beginning. It's a real tedious pain in the ass because everyone's looking at it. Everyone's making sure, you know, they get their stamp on it. And that, you know, it's all also, it's they're all paying extra attention. And then once you get like past the first few issues, then it's just a lot easier. And then if a major event's going to happen, you'll notice, like, you know, all of a sudden people are all starting to comment more. And, you know, actually, this is a quote directly ripped off from Larry. He's like, once you prove that, you know, it's successful, when they don't care about it and you make it successful, then they'll come and tell you how to do it right.
Are there questions from the audience?
It's a curious question. So I was probably in the group that found your comics much later than when they were published. But I was just curious because I know I've spoken to Larry before about his military influences and being on active duty. And I was just curious because you wrote some really great stories of the war with Hawk getting shot in the back and how he, like, for a long time, like, you couldn't talk about it. And so just how his whole life became like a special service. Like, did you have any military influences you got tapped into when you were writing the book? Or?
I was overseeing those stories, but I wasn't directly writing those, but still, I never served. I did, my stepdad was in the Air Force. I grew up on like Page Manor and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for a while. And I was in Fort Meade, Maryland for a while. So I got enough of like the kind of like the culture, but like, that's why I always made sure to have like we had military consultants on there and you know, definitely never had any like the super technical military level detail that Larry puts in those. More of the fantasy action side of it, you know. But yeah, that's about my level of experience.
Now it's
made it so much easier now to write those kind of stories because it's so much easier to search for that information if you're missing it. But yeah. Anybody else?
I want to say thank you. You're awesome. I remember reading all the press and all that before it came out. Excited and seeing the Wizard and all that. I got the first issue, first read, and I bought every single issue brand new as soon as it came out. But Conqueror and Xenia and all that, can you talk about that? Like, how did Hasbro accept him, and how did you pitch him to do two characters?
Oh, I didn't have to pitch him at all. He's talking about Xenia and Conqueror and like characters that I created. Yeah. That was like the very first issue. That's back when, like, I don't even know if they knew that I created those characters, you know. Sometimes I wonder if they still do. So yeah, there was no pitching of that at all.
So with Xenia, I mean, what made you decide that Zartan should have a daughter? I mean, was there just
I think it was just me thinking, like, okay, it's been several years since the characters are supposed to have been gone. So what's changed in the span of time? So, and it just was the obvious fun thing to have. So it's changed the dynamic with that, and excuse to have a cool, like punk rock girl in there running around. Probably also just to keep adding like a little more female characters into it as well. I mean, G.I. Joe was always way ahead of its time in having a great, like, diverse cast. Like, I think it kind of blows away almost anything from, you know, previous era. So... yeah, and then Kamakura was just really... Kamakura was one of those things, like how Boba Fett was kind of an afterthought, I think. Like, I just wanted... I thought it'd be cool if Snake Eyes graduated into being like... now he's Silent Master. And it's like Hard Master, Soft Master, he's Silent Master. Well, he needs like an apprentice who kind of like is there in his, you know, little isolated, you know, temple or whatever. And that was the idea for Kamakura. And I thought, well, who would that be? Oh, man, what if it was the kid that wrote the letter to him? You know, what if it was Wade Collins? And that was pretty much it. That was the, and I wanted to, like, make him a ninja, but give him a little more of like the military colors and, you know, to get away from them. Because I knew I was adding another ninja, and I didn't want to give any indications of being like Ninja Force, doing the joke about never don't go full ninja.
Can I ask a very specific question? So, it's, you know, in your role as publisher and things, you can literally sort of, you know, approach your art heroes and ask them to work with you, and you know, brought Larry into the fold. But an interesting one was having Michael Golden, I think, did the very last cover to the final issue of America's Elite. Are you able to talk to that experience of bringing someone like Michael Golden?
Yeah, only because you asked. Yeah, I mean, Michael, we just always wanted Michael Golden to do a cover. I mean, that was like an awesome get. And then he did this like triple gatefold cover, you know, where like you folded it out. And but that was when the approvals were getting really difficult. So they made us take out, like, he had to take out guns, had to like change the angle of where the guns were pointing. So it, well, that was one of those like, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, so there's another version of that out there. If there's a scan anywhere or something, you know, of like what the original cover looked like.
Artists don't like it when the licensing company tells them to make stuff less interesting. David?
World War III, I thought, was a very ambitious story for your last year, I guess, of publishing G.I. Joe. I felt that it really didn't deliver on what it was advertised as, this world war of the entire planet that Cobra had taken over, all of Earth. And it was only done in 12 issues. I felt that maybe there were so many other stories in there. And now Rising Sun has kind of done a lot of fill-in stuff with World War III. What was the process of that, and why did it only have 12 issues? Why couldn't it have other stuff on the miniseries to tell them where Snowjob was, where this guy was, what's going on here?
There was more, like, that was when we knew the license was going to end.
Yeah.
So Hasbro, I think we had to push them to let us do that many issues. Because we kind of had to say, like, hey, you've already approved. They basically approved the storyline and then said, well, the license is going to be over. So it's like, well, you guys have approved it and approved marketing and approved advertising to your fans for the story. So they agreed to let it run its course as like a maxi series and then got to be done. So a lot of stuff. I can't say I have remember at all like what the plans were beyond that, because all I remember is, you know, we had to wrap it up. And
so
like
that during that process, you felt really rushed.
Yeah, sure. I know we wanted to kill Cobra Commander. That was because, like, hey, it's the end. Like, you're going to totally retcon this stuff anyway. So, and they were like, no, you can't kill him. That's too violent or whatever. So that's why he ends up in like a, spoiler alert, yeah, he ends up in like a water prison or something and all that. So, that's it. Fun business answer.
Maybe we'll do one more question from the audience, and I think I've got the wrap-up question. Anyone else in the audience got a question for Josh Blaylock? He will. If you're feeling shy, of course, he'll be at.
The answer is C.
Maybe in the other room.
Selling things, sketching things.
Which, if there are no more, that's just going to segue to my final question. So, anyone?
Okay, sure. Well, I think you had brought up 9/11 happening right at the same time that you were publishing the first issue. Was there any part of that in trying to integrate world events into what you were writing about?
No, that was like the opposite. That meant I definitely couldn't do stuff like. Like, I really had wanted to, like, play up that, like, because I had Cobra Commander been gone for several years. I was like, he's traveling the world using his charisma on all these different, you know, world leaders and terrorist groups and everything else. And now he's back. And he's, you know, will reveal he's formed a lot of these alliances. And it's going to be terrifying, like, what he might be able to do now. And then I was like, nope, you're not going to do that. That was already going to be a battle with Hasbro anyway. Like, I, you know, I wasn't going to try to make it too dark and edgy, but that even styled it back more. So,
Josh, what are you working on now?
What have
you been working on?
Yeah, currently I have a handful of different projects going on. It's the 15th anniversary of Mercy Sparks, which is my like supernatural action horror comedy, you know, just fun book. I've got two omnibus collections. It's in the development with MGM right now. And we've got, I've just finished a new issue of that. I'm drawing the book for the first time after writing it and developing characters for 15 years. Me and Mark Powers, who wrote World War III and used to edit the Joe books, we have a side project called The Encoded. We just did a hardcover collection for that. That's got some intentional, fun homages to some like winks and nods to Joe and Transformers kind of stuff. But it's really more like straightforward, serious sci-fi story about the year 2055. I had this like fantasy, alternate history, ancient Atlantis kind of a series called Ark World, which is like ancient aliens, but it's not about no aliens, it's the ancient stuff and all the mysteries, you know, behind all that. And yeah, I'm working on some other top secret things right now as well. Working with some like music, Web3 group, which has been fun, doing some like fun cartoony stuff about these skull characters called Wicked Craniums, and we have like a live action music video tied into it. That's been really fun. So Devil's Due Studios is the website to go to. I'm over there hanging out. And, yeah. Sign up the email list because I think I will have some stuff coming out that'll be exciting for this crowd, specifically sometime in the near future as well. Listen to this podcast.
Yeah, so if you like hearing people talk about comics, really getting into the weeds and talking to comic creators, doing a deep dive into the Devil's Due,
helping us remember all the things we forgot we did,
dropping some serious member berries, and so we've been doing a deep dive read through. We're sort of in the middle of the America's Elite era. We're going to cover that. We've been covering all of the Larry Hama A-Rod issues, and so going to do a big episode about 301 when that drops. Follow us on the socials, or head on over to talkingjoe.co.uk, which is the website, to find out more. I've got business cards, which I'm calling miniature art prints, which have got like that art on the back. So if you've not got one of those, up and over, and I'll give that hand.
It's been fun listening to these interviews with like people that worked with me or for me, like, you know, way back then too. Just hearing one, it's funny because you hear where you're like you learn some things and you're like you just hear from their perspective, and it's like it's just fun to hear like what I was focusing on this, the 8 hours a day and 4 hours of your day, we're just only doing that. So it's just interesting to see. And it's funny too when you're like when you hear like someone's completely remembering something backwards, you're like, no, that's not the order that happened in. And then I'm like, oh god, what have I said that it's like backwards? But it's fun. That's fun because you listen to those and you like kind of corroborate everything. It's like listening to a Larry Hama interview followed by a Jim Shooter interview, and you're like, I just don't match up the same.
Head to Josh's table where he's sketching and signing and selling books. Sign up for his stuff. And thank you, Josh Bullock.